Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast where we talk about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And those two developers are, like always, me, John Sundell, and my good friend from across the Atlantic, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hello, John. I'm doing great as usual. How are you?
I am doing really well. I've been, again, doing quite a fair amount of development over the last week or so. I've been exploring Swift UI even more, and I've been continuing my game-related Swift UI experiments.
Oh, game-related things in Swift UI. I saw you posted some of that stuff, and you also shared it with me, and it looks really interesting, some of the stuff you've done with Swift UI. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the previous hack or experiment that I did was it possible to build a game using Swift UI? And we've talked about that. Mm-hmm. But the new experiment is, would Swift UI be a good real alternative, not just a hack or experiment, but a real alternative for building game user interfaces? Because when you're working on a game, you both are rendering kind of the game scene and the game world and everything that's going on in the game, but you typically also have a fair amount of user interface. Like, you might just be displaying the player's health or score or something, but a lot of games have quite complex menus, especially the games that I like to work on, like in my spare time as hobby projects. They are usually like strategy games and things like this. And I've been playing around now with reviving one of my old projects, a online strategy game that I was actually running on the App Store back in 2013, so quite some time ago. So I think it's time for a reboot of that game.
Nice. And
I was building that now in a way where I'm using Imagine Engine, my game engine that I wrote, as the kind of game engine, like as rendering the game itself. But then I was putting Swift UI views on top of it and rendering them as these like textured menus with icons and game graphics. And it turns out that Swift UI works really, really well in this context. And the fact also that it's cross-platform is perfect for game development, because when you build a game, you typically want to ship it not just on iOS, but on as many platforms as you can. So me writing my games in Swift, that means all of Apple's platforms for now. And the fact that I can then write my user interface once with Swift UI is fantastic in this context.
Yeah, that's really nice. So how are you handling the customization of your UI? Because when you do a game, usually you're not going to be using like vanilla UI elements. I suppose the modifier stuff in Swift UI lends itself pretty well to that, where you can like create custom modifiers or attach modifiers and make your views look like the theme of your game. How is that working out for you?
Absolutely. That is a big part of why Swift UI is a good fit here, because it is really easy, or easier, I will say, than in frameworks like UIKit or AppKit to perform that kind of customization. And I know that that's not something you typically hear around Swift UI. You hear like, if you want to build standard components, then Swift UI is great. But if you want to do something custom, it is not great. But I kind of disagree with that. At least in my experience, applying modifiers and composing different things is actually making it easier to build custom UI, at least as far as my experience goes. So two core modifiers that I was using to build this initial UI, and we'll put a link in the show notes to a tweet where I show a screenshot of this UI that I was building. And those two modifiers are, first, the resizable modifier on image. So you can take an image and you can turn it into a resizable image. And typically you would do that by giving it an aspect ratio and saying like, here, I want to take this image and I want to make it resizable. But there's another thing you can do with that. You can give it cap insets. And this is something that UIKit also supported, where you can take an image and essentially slice it into 9 slices, where you have the corners are static and then the middle parts are tiling. So if you have a game graphic where you have like a textured background that can tile, but the edges are not supposed to tile, like you want those to just be on the edges, then you can use this API to slice those graphics very easily, and Swift UI will automatically resize them according to the view. And so that was really nice for building backgrounds and like these more textured panels and things like that, while still being able to use like lists and VStacks and HStacks and everything. But then the second part was the blend mode modifier. And this is, again, like, an order of magnitude easier to do in Swift UI than in the previous frameworks, where if you want to change the blend mode of a given view, for example, if you want to use the multiply blend mode to take a colored mask, for example, and apply it to a character or something in order to render them using different colors, you just say dot blend mode dot multiply. That's it. That's how easy it is. So I am really, really happy to see Swift UI work so well in this context and to really be very customizable even in this sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you when you say that you feel like it's easier to customize things in Swift UI. And I know that if you're used to doing UIKit and things like that, it might feel weird because it's a different way of thinking. And that's the biggest problem when learning Swift UI is changing the way you think to fit the way the framework works. But I'd say as well, like, it's a lot easier. Of course, there might be some things that are not exposed the way you'd like. And I think mainly around things where you have to deal with the system, like navigation controllers and things like that. That stuff I'm still doing in UIKit, even in my like side projects where I use Swift UI, because I feel like that's where the most work has to be done before it's more ready for all use cases. But it's a lot easier to like create a custom button in Swift UI. You don't need to know like these 10 properties that you have to override and the superclass is going to override them in a different way and do something weird. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It's a lot easier.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a good way to maybe summarize it is to say building custom UI, like the pixels and drawing custom UI, is easier in Swift UI, at least in my experience, and it seems like in yours as well. But if you want to customize an aspect of the system, for example, if you want to customize lists and add certain things to them, like swipe behaviors and things like that, you basically need that to be exposed as part of the API, or you have to go back to UIKit and wrap it and import it into Swift UI that way. So I think that is like two ways of looking at customization. It's either you are building something custom or you are customizing a behavior of a system component. And I do agree that in the second instance there, when you're customizing a system component, that is not always easier. Sometimes there's something missing that was easy to do in UIKit, but it's just not there yet in Swift UI.
My pet peeve with Swift UI is with navigation view and navigation title. And if someone knows a workaround for this that doesn't involve like recreating the whole thing, please let me know. But one thing I like to do, and I have in some of my apps, and this is quite a common thing nowadays in iOS apps, is to use the rounded font for your large title in a navigation controller. And I haven't been able to do that in Swift UI. I haven't figured out a way to do that. So if you know a workaround, please do let me know. And I haven't filed a feedback for that, which I totally should. I'll get to that after we finish recording.
Perfect. And I know that you have been diving into Swift UI a lot more lately, Rambo, even at the job. Is that right?
Ooh, I have a good one to tell our listeners.
All right.
We are doing a project in Swift UI at the job.
Excellent. So it turns out that Swift UI is production ready.
Well, it depends.
We'll find out, right?
Yeah, I guess we'll find out. So this is a new thing within the app we already have, which supports iOS 12 and above. But this is a feature that in discussion with the product team and looking at our analytics, we wouldn't benefit by supporting iOS 12 with this feature because our iOS 12 user base is very small when compared to the iOS 13 one. And when we looked at the amount of time we could save by using not only Swift UI, but everything that was new in iOS 13, like Combine and all of the cool stuff with compositional layout in collection view and diffable data sources, and all of that stuff, we came to the conclusion that it was definitely not going to be worth it supporting iOS 12 for this new feature. So we are doing it. It's a little bit tricky with keeping support for iOS 12. We're not bumping up the deployment target. we're just supporting iOS 12, but this new feature is going to be iOS 13 only, so we're going to use the availability stuff. And the problem is that we have everything that touches SwiftUI, we have to add the at available thing. So we have a snippet that we made for that to make things easier. But yeah, we're doing it. I think it's going to be fun. It's been in the works for about a week, and we are way further ahead than we would be if we were doing this with UIKit. And the strategy we're using, besides the thing with making sure that it's only available on iOS 13, otherwise it would not work, of course, is doing, like I mentioned, we're using SwiftUI for views, basically, but not for like the structure of the things. Like, we're not replacing view controllers and navigation controllers and collection views and things like that. We're using SwiftUI for the views themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's a very reasonable first step, right? Like, you don't need to rewrite everything. You can start where it makes sense to start. And in your case, since you are building a new feature that you're then going to integrate into an existing app, then it totally makes sense to leave all of the layers that's going to touch the previous parts of the app, like the existing parts that also support iOS 12, to leave those in a state where they can easily interact with the other code, right? Yeah. So if you would have done it the other way and you would have gone complete SwiftUI there as well, you would have to write some kind of bridging code to make those work together. But now you can just take your normal view controller, your navigation controllers, and you can just integrate them into the rest of your UIKit-based app, which I think is a really good strategy.
Yeah, and it's also all in a separate framework, so a separate module. And we conditionally link SwiftUI into that. So we optionally link, I mean, so that it will work for both cases. I think we're doing it in a nice way and in a way that won't cause us any trouble. But I will, of course, be updating you and our listeners as things progress.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And do I read the show notes right here when it says that you started a new app project again?
Yeah, you know, I like going file new projects sometimes. And it had been a while since I had done that. I currently have in like motion, mainly AirBuddy 2, some things with Chibi Studio, but that's a lot less work right now. But I also have one quite large new app project that I've been working on and off for a while, and that I haven't talked about, like pretty much nobody knows what it is. And also I started a new one because I was having a shower last week, as you do, like at least once a week, right?
The great app idea incubator, the shower.
Yeah, so I was doing that, and I was thinking about an app that I use almost every day, and I have been unhappy with some aspects, and I was thinking, like, what would it be like if I did an app like that? And I started thinking, and the ideas started to flow, and I had some ideas of things that I haven't seen in any app of the category. So I decided, well, let me just do it. I'm not gonna say what it is yet, but I think it's gonna be fun. And this is like a hobby project. It's something that I'm doing on my free time, and probably gonna take a really long time and might not ship, so we'll see. But it's interesting anyways.
So I have a question about this. I think when I speak for a lot of people that this file new project in Xcode syndrome is quite real, where you get ideas from time to time. I certainly do, and I know a lot of other people do as well. And especially, like you said there, when you're using an existing app and you kind of feel that some parts of it are awkward, or you want to try to do it in a different way, you have this urge and feeling that you want to start a new project. But if you always start new projects, and I can speak from experience here, if you always start new projects, you will never finish any project. So Rambo, this is mostly for me actually, but I also want to share it for our listeners. Could you give me and our listeners also some advice around when do you actually start a new project like that? When do you act on that impulse versus when do you just kind of write it down and save it for another day?
Oh, well, that's really hard because I kind of suffer from the same problem. Like we talked about, I think back in our show with Casey, we talked about the app graveyard. Every developer has this graveyard of old projects in a folder. And I definitely have that.
But you still ship a fair amount of projects. Like you have Airbuddy, you have Fusion Cast, you have a couple of new things coming up. You are actually shipping things, which I think is more than other people do, myself included, when it comes to these hobby projects. Like I ship a lot of things, but those are mostly related to like my website and, you know, these projects that I do. But I start a lot of kind of hobby app projects and games and things like that that I have a hard time finishing. So do you have any advice?
It's hard. Like one of them, like you mentioned, acting on impulse. And I am definitely a person that will act on impulse in many aspects of my life, not only coding. But the thing is, like, trying not to do that. So in this example, I had the idea during my shower, as we've established, and I didn't do anything about it. I just kept it the back of my mind, and I thought, like, if the next day I was still feeling like doing it, then I would maybe start doing it. And I actually waited until the end of the next day before I did anything with the idea. It's the good old sleep on it thing.
Like, yeah.
When you, after you go to sleep and then you're rested, think about it again. Think about if it's something that you actually want to approach. And in my case, like at the end of the next day, I was still like, yeah, I kind of really want to do that. Just to see, like, will this work? Do I have a good idea? And also know what's a hobby and what's like a big project. Like, and sometimes the two can be confused, like, and they can change. Like, Airbuddy was a hobby. Like, it started as a hobby. It started as something that I wasn't even gonna ship. It was going to be just for me, just like a fun little thing. And the demand was astronomical. Like, I wasn't expecting it. So I decided to turn it into a real project. But this is supposed to be a hobby, so I'm not going to be spending like 10 hours a day working on it.
Got it. I think that's kind of my main problem when it comes to these hobby projects, where I have a lot of projects already that I work on that are not hobby projects. They are like projects I do for work, right? And then when I have a hobby project, I really treat it that way. I'm like, I'm mostly doing it for fun. I'm using it to play around with different Swift features. And since I love doing that, that's kind of the most fun part for me. So I end up like creating these different architectures and different code styles and try different patterns and different features. And then I kind of forget about building the app, you know? And, you know, you could look at that and say that's bad. But on the other hand, that gives me a lot of value and it gives me a lot of things to write about and new experiments to try, which is great. And also, it's fun for me. So I don't always feel like a project needs to result in something that I'm shipping, because I work on so many other projects where that's the case, where either if I'm working for a client, I, of course, have to ship something. If I'm working on my website, on articles, podcasts, etc., I ship those all the time. So having a project where I don't have the pressure of shipping and I can just play around and, you know, try different things and refactor to my heart's content, that is also really nice to have.
Yeah, definitely. That's also a really good point. Like, it doesn't have to be shippable in the end of the day. It can be something that you made just for you. And maybe it's something that you're going to use. We know stories about apps that someone wrote and they were the only user of the app for like 2 years, and then they decided to actually polish it up and release it. And that could be the case. Like, it could very well happen with this app that I'm making, that I'm going to be using it for several months or years, and then I'm finally going to decide that it's good enough to ship, or that there's a market for it. Otherwise, it could be just a hobby thing that never chips, and I'm at least going to have had fun and learned a lot doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Nice to talk about shipping things. And of course, Apple, they're also continuously shipping things. But this week in our In the News segment, we want to talk about something that perhaps they will ship, perhaps they won't. We will see. And Rambo, tell us more about this.
Well, I think on an infinite time scale, they are going to ship this.
Probably, yeah. That's a fair bet, I think.
Yeah, so our colleague Felipe at 9to5Mac has found some evidence in Big Sur that suggests Face ID is coming to the Mac.
All right. It feels like inevitable, like you say, not even on an infinite time scale, but on a more close time scale.
On a finite time scale.
Right. It does feel like a Face ID will come to the Mac because it's been such a success on both iPhone and iPad. So I would be surprised not to see it on the Mac as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I've seen some other reports about Face ID on the Mac. And it's the old thing, like when I was more doing spelunking every day, like I used to do, you would sometimes find like, oh, there's this Face ID glyph on the Mac. Face ID is coming to the Mac. Yay. And sometimes that's not the case. Like it's something that's there for iPhones, and it's the same code base, so it just ended up on the Mac. But in this case, it looks like it's actually like a kernel extension or something that's related to the TrueDepth camera system, and it's specifically compiled for the Mac. So I think that's a pretty clear indication that there is some sort of Mac hardware out there that will support Face ID.
Do you feel like some of these things that we're going to see, where we're going to see iOS features appear on the Mac, might also be to support Apple Silicon and the fact that Apple Silicon powered Macs will be able to run iOS apps, which presumably also means that they will need to perhaps have a copy of some of these frameworks, even if they don't do anything, just to make those apps run?
Yeah, they will have the frameworks, but in the specific case of Face ID, and I don't want to like explain the whole architecture here, we could be here for hours, but basically there are a few frameworks that handle biometric authentication. It's actually quite well abstracted, so the frameworks the apps talk to, they don't know much about Face ID or Touch ID. They just know biometric, and there is an enum of the type of biometric system that the system has, which you can query just so you can handle like things in your UI and show like, oh, use Face ID or use Touch ID. But in this case, it's actually a kernel extension. So it's a lot deeper than there would have to be support for like an iOS app that possibly links against like this symbol that talks about Face ID. Is that clear or not?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very clear. Like it's not just there for something that an app can link to, but actual functionality in the kernel that the system presumably will use at some point. So yeah, that's totally clear. And do you think that this transition, if it happens, like if there are Macs being introduced with Face ID, do you feel like that will happen along with the Apple Silicon transitions? Like, do you think that the first Apple Silicon powered Mac might support Face ID?
I don't think so. I think it'll be a little bit early. And I wanted to talk about this story, not just because of the discovery itself, which, as we mentioned, like it's pretty much a given that at some point Macs are going to have Face ID. But I wanted to speculate about the actual form factor and functionality of Face ID on the Mac. Like, let's say that the first portable Apple Silicon Mac is a MacBook Air. You've probably seen a MacBook Air. I think our listeners probably know what a MacBook Air looks like. There is no space in the lid to fit a TrueDepth camera system, unless they have like some magical new TrueDepth camera system. Because you look at your iPhone, if it has Face ID, and you think like, oh, it's this thing on the notch. But the notch is just a window into the system, and if you actually open up the iPhone, it pretty much fills up the entire space, like the thickness of the device. It's not like a super thin camera system.
Exactly. So the question then is, could they place this true depth camera system somewhere else? And one thing that comes to mind is perhaps right below the lid. So like to angle it like 45 degrees, so it would still be pointed towards your face, but from a kind of a downwards angle. Do you think something like that could work?
Yeah, I'm no optics engineer, but I don't know. We've seen some pretty crazy stuff with optics, and even current iPhones and iPads, the amount of angles they can work at is pretty impressive.
Especially on the iPad. Like, yeah. The iPad, I am continuously surprised by the range of Face ID. Like, I use my iPad a lot in the kitchen when I'm cooking or something like that. And I typically have it, like, on a table, not close to all of the ingredients and, you know, places where it could get damaged or wet and things like that. So I keep it out of harm's way. And I typically just turn around and I hit the space bar and I'm kind of far away. I'm kind of stretching over just to look at a recipe or something. And it unlocks like from really far away. So that is really impressive.
I have, and you're going to laugh at this, but I have an iPhone X that I use for testing. And that's my kitchen phone.
it's the same phone as I use. That's my production phone.
If I need to follow like a recipe or something, especially if it involves like making a dough or something, which is
you just sacrifice the iPhone X,
which is can be quite messy. So yeah, I take this. I like put the recipe in notes and I share it over AirDrop to this separate iPhone X. And it's the one I use while making dough. It's my dough phone.
All right. Yeah, I still use my iPad, but I do keep it out of harm's way. And I try not to get any dough or liquid or anything inside of the keyboard. But yeah, it is really cool just how good Face ID is in that context and just how wide of a range it has. And that also does lead me to believe that there could be something where an option could be to put it like right below the lid or to do something crazy like to shoot the beams and then there will be like a mirror that mirrors it into your face or something like that.
Yeah, and that's something that I thought, like, what if it's, I don't know, hidden in the touch bar somewhere and it's like an angled thing that projects beams at a 45 degree angle or something. I could see that maybe, I don't know. But also another thing is how useful or how much better would Face ID make the Mac be? Like, is it really necessary?
I think it would make it a lot better. Really? I mean, just look at the iPad. I love Face ID on the iPad. The fact that I can just always hit the space bar and I'm immediately into my device and I can start typing, I can start working on it. That is awesome. Like, I would love to have that on a laptop.
Really? Like, for me, I use the Apple Watch unlock, and by the time I finish opening the lids, it's already unlocked. And if it's not because I'm not wearing the watch or it's been, I don't know, it expires after a while, so you have to Touch ID again, then I use Touch ID, and also for authentication and things like that. I think the context, and that's of course a very personal thing, but the context where I use my Mac wouldn't improve my experience significantly with Face ID. Of course, it would be more convenient because you just look, but I don't know, it's just not that big a deal for me on the Mac. On the phone, like an iPad, especially on the phone, it's a huge deal for me. Like, I'm a huge fan of Face ID on the phone, but on my Mac, yeah, I think it's quite the technology, like in terms of how expensive it is and how tricky it will be, where the benefit will have to be a little bit more than just, it's a little bit more convenient.
You have to remember which company we're talking about here. We're talking about Apple, which have proven time and time again that they will jump through a lot of hoops in order to have something cool to show us, right? And another thing that Apple loves is consistency across their lineup, right? True. I mean, at least in theory. And this would also be a big consistency point, I feel like. Like, if the devices all unlock the same way, that is a pretty big win, I think. So You don't have to explain to people like, oh, on this device, you have to use your finger. On this device, you have to type a password. On this device, you can use your face. Like, it would be pretty great if they all unlock the same way. So you could just walk up to it and use it.
I can destroy your argument.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Phones are going to get Touch ID back. I'm pretty sure they are. Like, I think not this year, but I would be willing to bet that 2021 phones are going to have both Touch ID and Face ID. And I think the Mac would be the same. So maybe they're waiting because they want to like introduce the multi-biometry system all of this at the same time across the lineup. So I think like consistency, I agree with you that like you would have the same options on all devices. But I don't think, I don't agree that Touch ID is dead. I think it's still going to be there.
Right. And I'm not saying that either. If it's going to be like a dual system where you can use either Touch ID or Face ID, then that's great. I mean, more options, the better, right? But I do still think that Apple's end goal is to have the same capabilities on all of their devices. At least it feels like that's where they're heading.
And if you're really paranoid, then you can like require both Touch ID, Face ID, and Apple Watch authentication to unlock
your Mac. A password. And a blood sample.
Blood ID.
Exactly. All right. So really interesting story. Let's see how this is going to continue to develop and whenever we're going to find more clues of Face ID and a true depth camera system within Macs. But now let's move on to our deep dive, which is going to be about Async Await. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by iMazing, the most popular all-purpose iPhone and iPad manager for Mac and PC. Head over to imazing.com/stacktrace to learn more and to get a 30% discount on your license. With iMazing, you can make Time Machine-style scheduled backups of your iOS devices to your own storage, either over Wi-Fi or USB. Once you have a local backup, you can then browse files, photos, contacts, notes, and calendars, and more straight from any backup snapshot and recover just what you need. Backups can and should be encrypted, and they're 100% compatible with iTunes and Finder backups. And for developers, iMazing's file browser is a great way to get precious insight into how iOS's file system is structured without having to jailbreak your device. It lets you understand what parts of your app's data that gets backed up, what kind of data third-party SDKs store, and it lets you quickly test various scenarios by populating your app's library and documents folder with test files. iMazing is made by a team of passionate Mac developers, and it shows. It's already updated for macOS Big Sur, and is always quickly updated to support the latest iOS betas. For example, iOS 14 is already fully supported. Other development-oriented features includes a device console, access to device log files, the ability to reinstall iOS versions without erasing your device, exit recovery mode, battery diagnostics tools, and more. So head over to imazing.com/stacktrace to try iMazing for free right now. And by using that link, you not only directly support me and Rambo and help us continue to make Stacktrace, but you'll also get a 30% discount on your iMazing license as well. This offer is valid until iOS 14 gets publicly released, and just like I mentioned, you can also try it completely for free. Once again, that's imazing.com/stacktrace. Thanks a lot to iMazing for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo. So speaking of new evidence of new features, we wanted to do a deep dive into Async Await this week. And the reason for that is that there is a new pull request in the Swift open source project, which is adding support for the async keyword, which is really interesting because there's been a lot of debate around what kind of asynchronous abstractions to adopt as kind of first class members of the Swift language. And there's a couple of different options, and we can talk a little bit about them. We can talk a bit about what Async Await is, of course, and some other languages that have adopted it. But it is really interesting just to talk about that pull request first to see, like, you know, here's an open source project, which kind of is hinting a little bit as to how Swift might progress in the future.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's worth mentioning that this is not like implementing async await in Swift.
Right, right, of course.
This is basically just, John, it's just adding the async type, basically the keyword. I think that's what it's called, right? So it's making the Swift type system understand that there is a thing called async that can be applied to functions.
Exactly. So it's kind of laying the groundwork for that. Yeah. But it is interesting because, like I mentioned, there's been a lot of talk around different abstractions, and async await seems to have been getting an extra amount of traction over the last couple of years. So it does seem like that is where we're heading, which I am personally really happy about. Yeah. So should we talk about what async await is? Do you want to give it a go explaining what async await is, Rambo?
I can try. Probably not the best to do this, but let's see. It's going to be fun.
And then next week, I can explain kernel extensions. You can get back to me.
Kernel programming is voodoo magic. So
perfect.
Just as async await. So my experience with async await is with JavaScript. I think I also used it in C# a little bit. But basically, you can declare a method or a function as async. And when you do that, you can await for stuff in it. And await basically means this is going to run asynchronously. But when you await on something, you don't have to create a block or a separate function that's going to receive the results. You basically write your codes in a linear fashion, but it's going to run asynchronously. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, absolutely. That is perfect. That is really what it's all about, is to give you a first-class way in the language to write asynchronous code almost as if it was synchronous. That's kind mm-hmm. of the end goal. And there's a lot of different abstractions that enable you to accomplish this. For example, we talked about Combine earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And Combine does also aim to do the same thing, but in a different way. So with Combine, you can set up these reactive pipelines where you apply operators to one publisher and then you get another publisher back. And that also lets you write your synchronous code in a more synchronous fashion, where the operators that you're applying, you're all applying synchronously. You don't have to have completion handlers or nested code and things like that. You can do it all kind of in the same scope. And that is really nice, but then it gets resolved and processed asynchronously under the hood. So that's one way. And then you have futures and promises also, which is also another take on that same problem and that same kind of philosophy of trying to enable you to write asynchronous code in a synchronous fashion. So async await is really like the way I would explain it as like what value it gives to a developer. It's kind of like imagine being able to write futures and promises or combine code, but in a way that is kind of baked into the language itself.
Yeah, and I believe in JavaScript, that's how it works. Basically, an async function can return a promise. And when you await, you're basically saying, observe this promise and wait for it to deliver or to fail. And if it can fail, you can actually use try catch in JavaScript. So if your promise catches an error, it's going to trigger your catch block. So I imagine in Swift, it would be something similar where let's say you have something that today is a completion handler with a result. So it can be a success or a failure. You could write it as await do something, and then you could put that in do catch to catch errors. That would be great.
Yeah, that would be really great, because you need some way for your actual synchronous code to observe that end asynchronous result, right?
Yeah.
Because if you have an async function, and then inside of it, like you talked about before, you can await many different things. So you can, for example, say await resolve URL, then await load data, then await decode image, right? And then you return that image. So inside of your load image function, everything looks synchronous, but it's actually asynchronous under the hood. Mm-hmm. But then where you're calling that function. For example, you might be calling it in a button handler or in some other kind of UI code. You need to be able to observe that result somehow without using the await keyword there. Because if you use the await keyword there, then that enclosing function needs to be async. And then you end up with this pyramid of async, and then your app delegate needs to be async, right? Which doesn't work. So then you would need something like a future or a promise or something like combine maybe. Maybe they would build bindings into combine for this, which would be pretty cool. Or something else, maybe hook it into Grand Central Dispatch and enable it to pass on a value. There are many different options here on how the end API could be implemented, but I do also think that futures and promises is a very nice kind of fit for async await.
Yeah, absolutely. John, would you be able to like describe to me and our listeners what your ideal version of async await would be for Swift? That since you're the Swiftiest one here.
Sure. So I think you would declare an asynchronous function as an async func, right? So instead of just saying func and then the name of the function, you would say async func. There are a couple of different options here, though. You could treat it as an attribute. So you could say just like how you can say at view builder and then func and then define a function that uses a view builder. You could treat it the same way and say maybe async is actually an attribute. So you would do an at sign. So you'd at async and then func. Mm-hmm. I still think that you want to treat it as more like a keyword than an attribute. So I would probably just go without the at sign. So just async func. And another option that was also discussed, you know, has been discussed for many months around this back and forth, is maybe you should treat it like the throws keyword. So when you have a function in Swift that can throw, you say, for example, func decode, and then you say throws at the end. So would you then put async there as well? So you would say func load image async. But I think that would read kind of weirdly. I think you want async to be upfront.
This is going to be a super fun discussion topic in the Swift forums. I can feel that.
Yeah, like, for sure. I mean, it already has been. There's a lot of threads and a lot of comments about it.
I'm going to say, after reading a little bit about it, I think I prefer the version where async goes after the function and before the return, kind of like throws. Because to me, it reads like this will asynchronously return this thing, if you know what I mean. I think, yeah, to me that sounds a little bit, I don't know, sounds more natural, but I do understand that it will be more compatible with other implementations if it will be in front of the keyword func. And I also agree that it should be a keyword and not an attribute. But we'll see. I'm going to be happy with whatever they pick. I always just adapt.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I don't really have any strong opinions about this. And some people get really worked up around these things. Oh, yeah. And, you know, they have a lot of heated debates. I'm not one of those persons. Like, yeah. I will just accept whatever the people who are actually language designers will decide. Because I'm not a language designer. I can be a language critic and I can be a language person who has opinions about a language, but not necessarily a language designer, right? I don't have really those skills at the moment. So either way, for me, I still think, like, I kind of think of it in a similar way as access modifiers, like private, file private, public. So you say public func, and in this case, you would say public async func, right? So I think, for me at least, that would kind of fit very nicely. But yeah, either way. And then, of course, using the await keyword, just like you use try right now. Mm-hmm. So if you have a function that can throw, you have to call it with try to have to call an async function with await. I think that makes sense. And also, you know, it's consistent with how other languages have implemented this, which I also think has a fair amount of value when people are, you know, coming to Swift for the first time.
Yeah, definitely.
But then we talked about also, like, how do you expose this? Like, do you use futures and promises or something else? And here I would honestly like to see different options. Like, I mentioned earlier that I would like to see combine bindings to this. So you could easily take an async function and immediately use it as a combine publisher. I think that would be super cool. Mm-hmm. And to also give some options for platforms that don't have combine or where you don't want a full reactive pipeline. You just want to be able to observe a result. And perhaps even to be able to immediately plug it into Grand Central Dispatch as well. So you can say which queue you want to run it on or something like that.
Oh, yeah, that would be awesome. I would love that. I love it when APIs let me specify my own queues.
Yeah, because you always have your own queue, don't you, Rambo?
Of course I do. Yeah, I was thinking that it's kind of funny when we were talking about the new attributes and keywords and things. I was writing some code for the hobby project yesterday, and it is quite funny how long your declarations can get in Swift. And some people made fun of it, like, oh, it's kind of like Java now, where you have like these huge, because yeah, you can have some big declaration, like a public private set at publish public private set lazy var something. it can be a little bit funny, but I totally get it. And I think if you're just getting started, you don't need to know all of that stuff. It was quite funny because I used a private set in the job in one of my pull requests. And one of the engineers was like, oh, I didn't know that. Because it is something that you sometimes don't come across, but I use it all the time.
Yeah, and also Swift has so many language features. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been able to write every week about Swift now for over 3 years. And, you know, there is a lot of things to cover. And I still have so many things I want to cover. So it's a very, very broad language in terms of features. So I think it's very common to encounter features that you haven't seen before, or that work in a way that you didn't expect, or that have features that you didn't know about. So that is very, very normal. I don't think there are a lot of people who know every single language feature and exactly how all of them work and all of the different details about them. I'm trying to get there, but it's still a journey, you know, like it's such a big language.
Yeah, and it also lets you create things that look like language. They don't look like, oh, this is an API that someone else wrote. They kind of fit in with the language, and that's one of my favorite things about Swift.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also wanted to touch a little bit on how async await typically works technically. Mm-hmm. Because we mentioned that there is a bunch of different ways to do asynchronous programming. And at the end of the day, in a classic kind of execution model, you have threads. So each thread of execution has its own kind of pool of memory, and it's executing in its own fashion. And then you can jump over to different threads. You can do like multi-threaded programming in order to do things in parallel. And then Apple, they have Grand Central Dispatch, which is a abstraction on top of threads. So you can instead deal with queues, and then queues can execute their code on separate threads or on the same thread. Like, that's something you don't typically care so much about apart from the main thread when you're using Grand Central Dispatch.
Yeah.
But async await typically is implemented using something called coroutines, where a coroutine is a little bit different than a thread, where when using coroutines, the execution state of a given function can kind of be frozen, and then you await, hence the name await, the result of that coroutine, and then you bring back that execution context, and then you continue. So it doesn't require you to manually jump over to another thread or queue, but the language runtime will take care of all that for you.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I've never actually used coroutines. I've only read about them.
Yeah, it's not something you really use. It's just like, mm-hmm, how async await is typically implemented.
Oh, nice.
Cool. So I'm really excited to see how this is going to play out and what's going to be the next step here. And hopefully we'll see some Swift evolution proposals soon with more details. And yeah, maybe one day we will have async await.
Definitely.
Great. But now let's round off this episode with our Ask Stacktrace segment, which, to remind everybody, is the segment where you, our dear listeners, can ask us any question that you'd like. You can always ask us anything. There's always AMA time here on Stacktrace. And we're going to kick it off with a question from Davuth. And Davuth wants to hear if we have any best practices on how to model API objects. For example, let's say that the APIs for lists and details return different kinds of properties. And then Davuth continues, should all properties then be optional? Should the list and the detail API use different models? And how do we separate something like an app model from an API model? So this is a very broad question, I feel like. So we could probably do a whole episode on just this. But Rambo, what would you say are your kind of core best practices when it comes to designing these kinds of models and dealing with these kind of model variations.
Yeah, so you have many options, I think, and definitely having everything be optional is not a good idea. Like, it doesn't feel good to have a bunch of optional stuff when it's not really optional, because when you think about it, it's not like your object has a lot of optional properties in the list. It's that it does not have those properties, basically. They're not coming for you from the API. So what I suggest is, first of all, forget your UI completely, or the opposite, or do your UI and then think about your API, but never like work on something that's touching the UI thinking about how your API works. It's a recipe for not abstracting things in a good way. And you can end up with something like a model object with lots of optional properties that are not shouldn't be there, basically. So one option is to have separate models. So you could have, let's say we're working on an e-commerce app and you have a product model, and on a list it only has an image, a price, and a name. And of course, in the detail, it's going to have a lot more stuff. So you could have a product list item model or a product detail model, or the names don't matter. We could discuss the names forever, like we mentioned. So yeah, that's a good idea. And another option, if you're working with view models, is you can treat that in your view model. So you can have separate view models for list and detail and deal with those differences there. I would suggest it's a little bit more work, but I think it's always a good idea to not use the same models you get from your API in your UI layer. You should probably always have a separate model or view model to do that stuff, because then you keep the separation and you can freely transform your data between what comes from the API and what you display in your UI. I think that's usually the best idea.
Yeah, I agree. And it's also very common that you have view-specific state, right? Mm-hmm. Where you might be downloading a product model from your backend, but then you have local state, like, for example, how far has the user scrolled through the product page, or has the user marked a product as favorite? Like, that might not be something you're syncing with your backend. It might be local state, for example. So that also gives you the flexibility of adding things like that without making things weird, or without having to keep those things as optionals, because you have that specific model that gives you the flexibility to continue to iterate. And I also agree with you that having a separate list model from a detail model can also be great if they are different and if you have different sets of data in both. And that's something where you can spend a lot of time thinking and designing the perfect abstraction and the perfect way of sharing data between those two. You could do things like protocols, or you could have enums, you could have many different sorts of abstractions. But you know what's also fine? To just declare the same property in two different models twice, you know? Yeah. Like, that's not a huge problem in this case, especially if you're using Codable, especially if you are like decoding these from JSON and they're just like data transfer objects, then that's not a problem at all, I don't think. I think we should just like focus on making our models a great match for the data that will populate them. And one neat way of organizing these models, just kind of like semantically in your types, can be to, you have a product type, like struct product, for example, and then it has variations for detail and list. You could implement those as nested types. Yeah. So you could say extension product struct list item. So then when you're using that, you can say product.listItem, which reads really nicely and also gives that list item a very nice context, so that you always know that you're dealing with a product list item. And you can implement different list items that way for different types of models, which I think is really neat.
Yeah, definitely. And another option is to have your basic model be a property of your complex model. So if you have a product detail model and a product list model, you could have maybe it's not a product list model, but it's like a basic product model, and it only has like the most basic information. So you could have that be a property of your complex, your detail model, which is like basic info or something. That's also another option I've seen used. So yeah, there are many, many things you could do to solve this problem. And I think definitely having all the properties be optional is not a good way. I think someone here has written an article about that, right? About non-optional optionals.
Yeah, someone has. Yeah. And we'll definitely put a link to it in the show notes. And a couple of other ones as well. I have one called Handling Model Variations, which is very much touching on this particular topic. So we'll leave a link to that in the show notes as well. But one more thing I just wanted to bring up here is there's another use case for separate models, I think. And that's when you have a flow where the user is providing you with some data in different steps. So let's take a signup experience, for example, where the user starts signing up maybe by providing a username, and then they go to a next screen and they provide some additional data, like maybe they set a profile image and enter some metadata about themselves, and then a next screen. And it's the same thing there, really. Like, do you solve that by having one kind of user model that then has all these different properties as optionals? That's probably not very nice, right? Yeah. And in those cases, I like to use what I call a partial model. So I will have like a partial user, and that will then have all the different optionals that you can fill in there. But then when you reach the end of the flow, I call like finalize on that model, and that returns a real instance of user. And the benefit of that is that then the complexity of dealing with those optionals only exists within that signup flow where they are optionals. Like, yeah, the user might not have entered them yet, so they're optionals. It makes it also really easy to bind that to that particular UI. But then when we're done, I don't have to pay the price of having those optionals everywhere else in my code base because I had that local model that was only specific to my signup flow.
Yeah, that's a really good tip as well. And it's a way for you to keep things separated and abstracted, especially in, like in your example of the favorite property that might be local. Your UI layer should not be worrying about what comes from the API and what's local. Ideally, you should have a layered thing where by the time it reaches the point of showing up on screen, you have all of those as properties. And I actually do something in AirBuddy 2. I'm doing something like that where I have a device model and there's a bunch of knowledge about that device that does not come from the place where it's originated. So I created like this modifier architecture of sorts where I can add modifiers to the thing that's providing the device, and it's going to, after it discovers and updates the device, is going to run it through those modifiers. So it's a very functional architecture, John.
Nice. Sounds great. Yeah. Sounds very Combine or Swift UI-like. So of course I like that.
Yeah, and by the time it reaches the place where it's going to be transformed into what shows up in the UI, it already has all of the data in there. And the app itself doesn't need to care that, oh, this particular thing came from Bluetooth or this other thing came from mobile device or whatever.
Yeah, that's very nice. I think whenever you can model like a data flow as an actual flow of data, like an actual pipeline where you have different operations that do different things, I think that is usually very beneficial because not only can you then separate those different parts into different types or functions that can be built and iterated on and tested in isolation, but you also end up with a nicer overview of the whole architecture, where instead of just having one massive function that is called like load device in your case, right? You have these different parts that of course can also prove to be a challenge if you have too many parts and you don't know where they all are. But if you have a neat structure, then that can be really sweet where you can just like have these separate parts that can be iterated on separately, and then they all come together with composition.
Yeah, and in my example, it's modeling a reality of how things work, right? Because it is like that. Like, I don't get all the information from one source, so I do have to combine all of those sources together.
Nice. And now let's do our second and final question for this episode. And this one comes from Nikolai. And Nikolai wants us to speculate a little bit around how the Swift UI environment API works internally. So Nikolai says that he thinks that it must be a singleton that manages the Swift UI environment because you can access the environment from any view. But at the same time, you can have different environment objects within different parts of your view hierarchy. So, Rambo, do you want to speculate here a little bit? How do you think the Swift UI environment is implemented?
Associated objects or something? honestly, I have no idea. Like, it's a little bit beyond of my Swift knowledge, I think. I think at some point it must be something that's kind of like a dictionary, right?
Yeah.
But where exactly it lives? Maybe like it stores something that maps a certain object address with its associated environment objects. I don't know. What's your opinion, John? I'm lost here. I don't have a sure. decompiler ready, so yeah.
Yeah, I need to do some more spelunking. So I think the thing here that can be a little bit confusing is how can SwiftUI keep track of environment objects and state and properties and things like that when the views are just value types, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that work? But I think it's important to remember that SwiftUI internally does not just use value types. Like, we declare our views as value types, but internally, there must be some kind of controller or object that keeps track of each given view, because at the end of the day, it needs to be rendered using like a CA layer or a UI view or an NS view or something like that. So there is something somewhere. Let's just call it a controller now for just to establish some terminology. So there's a controller somewhere, I think, where that keeps track of a given view and that keeps track of its instance that it's being rendered, keeps track of its state, make sure that it gets updated whenever the state changes. Like, performs all of that glue, like the gluing of your struct that describes the view with the state, with the rendered result, like, and manages that whole lifecycle. And that's on the view level. But then you can go up a level and you can say, okay, but what about like groups of views? Then there's probably controllers for that too. But where do all of these controllers live? Like, is there some kind of mega controller, like a singleton that manages all of them? But then we have to remember UI hosting controller. Because how do you get your Swift UI view, like your struct, to be displayed? You embed it in a UI hosting controller, right? And yeah. That's an object. That's an object that has lifecycle. It can then manage the environment. It can manage all of these controllers. It can manage the hierarchy of controllers. It can pass the environment values down. So when you say in your struct environment object and you give it an environment object, it can pass that into the right leaf, like, or the right branch of the tree and keep track of it that way. So I don't think it's a singleton. I think it's managed by each UI hosting controller. And then there's like this tree of other controllers that keep track of each individual Swift UI view, and that those objects coordinate with the state, with the environment, with all of the different things in order to render Swift UI.
Yeah, it's more like a multiple tone, I think. Like, it is a singleton-ish in the context where it lives. I know what it is, John. It's a context.
Absolutely. You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if it was called context internally.
It probably is.
Probably, yeah. It's probably context or manager. Maybe context manager.
Oh, man. I'm not going to spelunk this because looking at Swift code in a disassembler kind of hurts my eyes. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it makes sense. And also, property wrappers themselves can also be reference types. They don't have to be value types, right? So, and they can also like reference types within them. They can be incredibly complicated. The machinery in there, who knows what it's doing, John? It's magic.
Who knows? Just go as an exercise to our listeners. If you want to learn more about this kind of, you know, how reference types and value types can interact, go, and we'll put a link in the show notes to Swift's string implementation, which is open source, like on GitHub.
Oh.
Because strings are not just stored as like an array of characters in a struct, because that would be terribly inefficient. Like, strings are stored on the heap, and I mean, not always, but sometimes they are. It's complicated. But they have like a reference-based storage, at least. They can be stored in memory elsewhere. And that is something that you can take advantage of yourself as well. It's a kind of advanced Swift technique. But I think it's important to remember that just because we have a value type, like a Swift UI view, it doesn't mean that there's no reference types ever. Like, there's always reference types involved somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like, even if we have a declarative user interface, even if we have a declarative API, there is state somewhere, and this state needs to be managed somewhere. And that's true also in the case of Swift UI. It's just not visible to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So what a deep dive episode, huh? We've gone really technically deep on this one. I really enjoyed it. So if you also enjoyed listening to this, and if you want to hear us go on more technical deep dives, then absolutely make sure to give us that feedback, because that's the only way we'll know if you like this episode or not. So even if you liked it, if you didn't like it, if you have some comments, we would love to hear from you. We really would. So you can do something simple. Just tweet at us on Twitter, of course. I'm at John Sundell, and Rambo is at _inside. And tell us what you thought. That would be really, really nice. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is, number one, for us to thank our great sponsor, iMazing, for making this episode possible. And also to thank you for listening. And finally, that's actually three things. But the final third thing is for you, Mr. Rambo, to say goodbye.
Goodbye.